Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to the show. I'm Justin Brierley, and this is Unbelievable, where we bring Christians and non-Christians together for conversations that matter each week. I've got a fantastic program for you today as we look at comets, cosmology and the Big Bang with Lord Martin Rees and Dr. Alan Chapman. I'll be introducing them both in a moment's time. We'll also be hearing later on in the show. I've got an interview for you at the back end of today's program with Frank Viola. His new book, Insurgents, Reclaiming the Gospel of the Kingdom. Look out for that at the end of today's program. And straight after today's show on The Profile, very special guest joins Sam Hales. It's Jackie Pullinger, well known for her ministry to drug addicts in China's Forbidden City, the story she told in Chasing the Dragon, probably one of the most famous Christian books out there. But Jackie is Sam's guest on The Profile between 4 and 5 this afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio, available on its own Profile podcast as well. And of course, Unbelievable is available as a podcast. Many people download it that way from week to week. If you want to check out our webpage where you can find the links to that, plus all the other good stuff you can get from Unbelievable, do go there. It's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. What we haven't quite got up there yet, though, is the forthcoming Unbelievable Conference, which is happening here in the UK on Saturday, the 20th of July. In fact, Tom got in touch to say, I'm a sixth form teacher in a school and looking to see if there's an Unbelievable Conference happening this year. Might be able to bring some students to any planned dates. And you're very kind about the show. Keep up the great work. Great video interviews. They've really encouraged and challenged some of my students. I'm hoping to make more of them at my sixth form to increase awareness. Your style, calmness during the interviews has a huge impact in that you demonstrate such a different way from the world in having such conversations. Thankful for your ministry. Thank you so much, Tom. Very encouraging email. And yes, there is going to be an Unbelievable Conference, as I mentioned, Saturday, 20th of July. That's the date to put in your diary. I can reveal that I'm so excited that all the way from California, J.P. Moreland, well-known Christian philosopher, is going to be joining us for this year's Unbelievable Conference. So look out for that. And I'm lining up a edition of Unbelievable soon, where we'll have J.P. Moreland in conversation with an atheist soon. So that's just delightful. Lots of other names will be joining us, and we'll be releasing the full schedule and names and topics and so on in due course. But for your diary, Saturday the 20th of July for Unbelievable, the conference 2019 here in the UK. Also plans afoot for another USA conference towards the end of the year, and watch this space for more on that. We're a transatlantic show these days, which is great and remarkable, and I'm really grateful for it. Something coming up a bit sooner, though, just before we get into today's discussion, a quick reminder, can science explain everything? It's an appropriate topic for today's discussion, but we'll be doing that with John Lennox and Peter Atkins. I'm going to be hosting a discussion between them at the University of Southampton. Now, that's a student event, but it will be a live cast to a nearby church in Southampton. That's Highfield Church in Highfield Lane, Southampton. It's happening on Thursday, the 31st of January at 7:30 p.m. So if you're a student at the university, why not get along to it? If you're in the area, why not go along to Highfield Church? Well, they'll be doing the special screening, and we will be live casting it wherever you are in the world via the Unbelievable YouTube channel. So put a date in your diary to tune into the Unbelievable YouTube channel at 7:30 p.m. UK time on Thursday the 31st of January to catch it live. And our YouTube channel can be found from the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Okay, preamble over, let's meet today's guests.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the show, we're talking about the past and future of cosmology, technology, and faith as well. Joined today by Oxford historian and fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society, Dr. Alan Chapman. His new book, Comets, Cosmology, and the Big Bang, gives a history of astronomy from Edmund Halley to Edwin Hubble, 1700 to 2000. Alan is himself a Christian and will be whizzing through 400 years of history, talking about how the pioneers of astronomy put their faith and science together. I'm also delighted to be joined on the line by the Astronomer Royal, Lord Martin Rees, who's well known for his work as a cosmologist and astrophysicist in the UK. Lord Rees is a former president of the Royal Society, and his latest book, On the Future, Prospects for Humanity, outlines how he believes we can prepare ourselves for the technological advances and challenges of the next few centuries. So, Alan and Martin, it's wonderful to be joined by you both.
It's a great delight indeed.
It's great to have you both. And Martin, you're joining us on the line today. Thank you for joining us.
Very good to be speaking to you and Alan.
I understand that you both have known each other for quite a long time. How far back does that go, Alan?
Good number of years. As I said rather amusingly, I remember you when you were merely Professor Rees.
Yes.
I've been honoured to know you for all of those years.
There you go. And I'm sure you have memories that go back a while also, Martin.
Well, through the RAS, of course, we go back a long time. But I think the last time we were together was when we both spoke at the Astrofest.
That's right.
Last year.
That was a wonderful occasion. And I also never forget one occasion dining with you, Martin, at the Athenaeum after the RAS, because it was the night before my sister-in-law died. And we were sat together, and I had to leave you partway through the dinner and get to a hospice in South London where we were with my sister-in-law, Miranda, all night. And we were with her, praying with her when she passed away the following day.
Gosh, wow. What?
But I remember we were dining together, and I had to give you my apologies, and I had to sneak away before dessert.
Well, look, I'm really looking forward to talking about both your books, obviously your friendship, both of your love of astronomy, and this is just a remarkable book. I've been reading it, Alan, and it's just a fascinating tour through the last 400 years, as I say, of cosmology. So much detail in there about the lives and culture and the history of the people who were involved. We'll get into some of that, but just to begin with you, did you sort of grow up stargazing yourself, Alan?
A lot of people have asked me this. I've always had a love of anything technical, going back as far back as making little cardboard railway engines and things of this sort. And I remember on one occasion when I was a little boy at Torquay with my parents, walking around Torquay Harbour on a summer's evening, and we were on holiday, and this would be in the probably early to mid-1950s, and there was the most beautiful half moon over Torbay. And I begged my dad for threepence to put into a penny slot telescope, and I couldn't tear my eye away from it. And I kept scrounging and scrounging and scrounging money, and it would click, it would cut off. And then I cobbled together a very, very simple telescope from a pair of old spectacle lenses and a watchmaker's loop, and it would show the moon to about 25 diameters from there.
Wow, extraordinary. So this was your introduction, I suppose, to looking up at the sky.
And, absolutely.
And, yep. And you've since obviously studied a great deal. You've lectured and taught and written a great deal on it as well. Before we get into the current book, your previous work, such as Stargazers, dealt with some of those common sort of controversies. And we were talking before we came on air about Galileo in particular, which I often meet. In fact, I had a conversation bizarrely only about this yesterday, someone saying, oh, but wasn't Galileo basically persecuted by the Catholic Church for his views on heliocentricity and so on? I mean, that's the common narrative. Yeah. What do you make of that as a historian?
I think it was invented in what I call the Endarkenment, what some people call the Enlightenment, when there was two agendas. First of all, to defame the Roman Catholic Church, and I'm not a Catholic, so I'm not defending the Catholic Church, but to defame the Catholic Church, and secondly, to defame Christianity. Because when you look at the records, the narrative of what happened, Galileo was actually a devout Catholic. He never ceased to be a devout Catholic. Yes, he had a mistress. Yes, he had illegitimate met kids, but so did several popes, so we can't really blame him too much for that. But basically speaking, he was a difficult customer. He loved needling, he loved insulting, and when he became really famous after his telescopic discoveries in 1610, and he was shot now into the highest levels of Renaissance Italian society, cardinals, popes, and so on, now people who knew him. And the kind of needling and horseplay you would have used as a Paduan professor did not go well down. And his fondness of just calling people things. In fact, one modern Italian scholar said that from Galileo's works, you could compile a good dictionary of Tuscan abuse.
Right.
So, and he was a Tuscan. And so I think we have to factor that in. And as we said earlier on, I think we have to contrast it with Kepler. Johannes Kepler, an exact contemporary, who was a declared Copernican before Galileo. He published on Copernicus before Galileo.
So espousing exactly the same theory,
exactly
in a sense.
Exactly the same period, 1620s, 30s, 40s, that sort of time. And Kepler himself was a devout Lutheran who never converted to Catholicism, yet worked his entire life in the employ of the Holy Roman Emperor in Prague and never got into any trouble whatsoever. Because, as I've said with Kepler, he knew how to behave himself. He knew how to hold his views, to advance his views, to respect Catholics, to love Catholics, not to insult them, and to say that science is based on argument, not on me calling you, as Galileo did, an idiot. A donkey, a pygmy, and those words were used by Galileo.
Gosh, wow. He spoke his mind. I mean, so obviously more to do with personalities
I think
than,
so, absolutely. Than the... But the idea of poor persecution, and also do we often forget when we look at pictures of Galileo, the contemporary portrait that survives in the National Maritime Museum in London shows Galileo at about 45. And in that picture, he looks just like an Italian cutthroat. And you can see this is not the wilting, sad Galileo of blessed memory. This is Galileo, if you cross me, mate, and I'll stick my knife in you.
Well, Galileo doesn't feature in the new book, but you paint equally colourful portraits of the various people involved in cosmology in the last 400 years. And I'm really looking forward to tracing some of them. We're going to be talking about Edmund Halley, who obviously is on the title there. One of the most significant women in astronomy, Mary Somerville, we'll talk about. And George Lemaître as well, the Belgian Catholic priest, often seen as the person who propounded the Big Bang theory first. But we'll get to all that. Martin, you share the honour of also being the Astronomer Royal alongside a few of the people mentioned in Alan's book. What exactly does that job involve?
Well, the job really changed in the 1960s because before that time, the Astronomer Royal was the person who ran the Greenwich Observatory, an important scientific centre, set up, of course, in 1675 to develop measuring of time, navigation, calendar, etc. But from the 1960s onwards, it became possible to fly to locations like the Canary Islands, Hawaii and Chile, which are far better environments for telescopes, clear skies at high altitudes. And what happened then, of course, is that the Greenwich Observatory became a museum. And it then became inappropriate to have a scientist in charge. And so what happened then was that the title was kept, but given to a senior academic astronomer. And that's been the case for the last four holders of the post.
Is it a sort of a lifetime thing, that essentially, the being Astronomer Royal?
There's no formal retiring age. I mean, I think I will retire at some stage. But of course, I cynically say that it's now so honorary that I can continue to perform my duties posthumously.
Very good. I mean, you're not a religious man, and you certainly don't share the faith of some of your predecessors in that role down the centuries. But in your new book, you do say if the number one question astronomers are asked is, "Are we alone?" Number two is surely, do you believe in God? My conciliatory answer is that I do not, but that I share a sense of wonder and mystery with many who do. And you later write as well, I describe myself as a practicing but unbelieving Christian. So what is that, Martin, if you don't mind explaining?
Well, I think the point is, I mean, I don't believe in any religious dogma or the uniqueness of any religious truth. I like to quote what Charles Darwin said about religion. He said, these matters are too deep for the intellect. A dog might as well study the mind of Newton. Let every man believe and hope as he can. I think that's a wonderful saying, and I suppose I would resonate with that. But I think having been brought up in a conventional English country, I got used to the English church, and I've been privileged to spend a lot of my life in Cambridge, where there's wonderful, beautiful buildings and aesthetics and music, etc. And I see the church as part of my culture, and I would like to see it continue and even strengthen. And in that spirit, I am very happy to attend its services, and I'd be happy buried in a country churchyard when I die. But I think it's rather like the lot of Jews, some of whom would say they're atheists, but they still think it's important to light their candles on Friday night and that sort of thing.
Sure.
Those are the customs of their tribe, as it were.
Yes.
And so I'm a Christian counterpart of that, in that I value the aesthetic traditions of the English church, and I'm happy to participate in them and support them when I can. I think it was someone who said that they were a buttress of the church, not a pillar, because they didn't go in very much, but they tried to support us from outside. I think I'm of that category.
Yes.
But I mean, if I was born in Iran, I'd probably go to the mosque in the same spirit.
I mean, interestingly, I understand one of your tutors at Cambridge was John Polkinghorne, who, of course, is well known for his own as a priest physicist, as it were, and theologian in his own right as well. So did his did at that time he kind of have any theories on how faith and astronomy go together, or was he influential in any way upon you?
Well, I mean, I never talked to him about these matters at that time. I mean, I went to his lectures. He was at that time a professor of theoretical physics, and I didn't really get to know him. But I have, of course, seen him in later years, and even appeared on platforms with him discussing faith and science.
Yeah, well, fascinating stuff. I'm interested just to see where the conversation goes. Very much an open-ended one today, as we talk about the past and the future. Because your book on the future, Prospects for Humanity, is about the future. There are constantly articles being written, of course, these days about where we're heading with artificial intelligence, robotics, transhumanism, and so on. Overall, do you see yourself as an optimist or a pessimist about the future of technology?
Well, I like to describe myself as a technical optimist, in that technology will allow us to provide a good life for the 9 billion people who'll be on this planet by mid-century. But I'm a political pessimist, because the gap between the way things could be and the way things are is wide, and I fear maybe getting wider, not narrower. So I'm not a political optimist, and I think that we're going to have a bumpy ride, because it's going to be very hard to control these technologies. There are two kinds of things that I think need to worry us. One is that because there are more people on the world, and all are more demanding of energy and resources, then, as is well known, we are risking despoiling the planet's environment and changing the climate and all those things. And so these collective impacts are something we have to control, and that's going to be a big political job, to get politicians to care about the global and the long term rather than the parochial and the immediate.
Yes.
That's a big problem. But there's another thing that worries me, and that is that it's easier with new technology and our interconnected world for a small group to cause massive disruption. And this leads to a lot of instability. We know about cyber attacks. We know about what one or two drones can do to an airport.
Yes.
And all these things. I think there's a worry that our quality of life is going to be degraded, simply because we'll have to have vexatious security do our best to avoid these concerns, which are more serious, because they could even cascade globally, because we're so interconnected. So those are the reasons I'm pessimistic.
Right.
That's a long answer to the question.
No,
I'm optimistic about technology and science, but I'm worried about whether it'll be applied widely. I'm worried also about growing tensions between three things we like to have, namely liberty, privacy and security. We won't be able to have all three.
In that sense, science and technology are neutral. It's about what humans do with them, ultimately, I suppose. Is
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I'm really looking forward, as I say, to the conversation as we look back and look forward today. Alan Chapman and Lord Martin Rees, both my guests on the programme today. And we're going to be talking about their books. And you're welcome to send your thoughts in as well on astronomy, cosmology, technology and faith. Do email in the show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find us online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Show's available there as a podcast. You can comment underneath it, share it on with others, and find links to our social media as well.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So continuing our conversation today, Alan Chapman joins me. Comets, Cosmology and the Big Bang, A History of Astronomy from Edmund Halley to Edwin Hubble is the title of the new book. As I say, it's so much interesting stuff in there. And I just thought maybe we could pick our way through a few of the characters that you focus on in the book there.
Could I also take up on some of Martin's points?
Of course.
Because I, in many, many, many ways, share his position. I fully accept the number of people who come to church because it's beautiful. What I call authorised version and Book of Common Prayer, AV and BCP, you come to. And AV, BCP, Stanford in C. The music, the beauty, and I know a lot of people like that. I was brought up a Christian, but my real sense of faith came as such by going to church, especially at Oxford, and just loving the whole culture of organized worship and realizing there's more to this than just the beauty.
Right.
There's something big behind it. So it played a major part there. And also, too, I serve at Christ Church Cathedral in Oxford as a scientist on Sunday mornings, and I just love welcoming anybody in from wherever in the world they are, because I work on the idea if they spend an hour and an hour and a half there, they're going to leave it better, feeling better than they came in.
I think many people, in a way, I think Martin's experience that he described there, I've heard from many people of yours and his generation. I wonder if the younger generation is missing out on the transcendent beauty, whether you believe or not, of simply attending a service like that. I was in Peterborough Cathedral over Christmas. And I'm not an Anglican, but I went in there and it was stunning. That the choral evensong is beautiful whether or not you believe what's being sung.
It's art. It's part of our artistic tradition too. And I love it. But it's surprising. I suppose Oxford's a bit skewed because you have lots and lots and lots, and Cambridge, very, very intelligent young people in a small space. And so you do get a continuity there. Yet in Oxford, the biggest church is St Aldate's,
where I attended in my days there.
Which packs them in, and of course is a modern worship church. And so I think there's that comes into it too. But to me, depends on your temperament. I've never been into rock and roll. And I was into Bach when I was 11 or 12. My parents thought this was barmy because they're like dance bands and things like that. You see, my dad used to say, oh, he likes that funny music. It's in Lancashire. He likes that funny music, you know. But captivated me. And it always has. And it also definitely deepened my faith. There's no doubt about that.
That's really helpful to hear. I mean, when it comes to looking at the history of astronomy over these 400 years that you cover in the book, to what extent is it a story of the church being a friend or a foe, would you say, of the science?
I would say a friend.
Right.
I mean, when you look at the list of fellows of the Royal Society in 1850, a good 50% are in holy orders. The great bulk of them Anglican, but Methodists, Roman Catholics, Baptists, and so on. Quite literally, vicars and science went together for centuries.
Now when I had Stephen Pinker on the show last year, we were talking about human rights and the kind of milieu in which that came out of, and the fact that obviously there's a strong Christian tradition in both science and philosophy and theology, obviously. But he said, well, that was just the water everyone swam in, was the way he described it. He said it was kind of expected that one would be a Christian.
But what was wrong with that?
Well, I suppose the question I'm asking, I suppose, on behalf of the well, being devil's advocate, as it were, is was that just the expectation that one would be an Anglican, a Christian,
and so on? Well, when you read their writings, they took it seriously.
Right.
Now, it's true that if you were a scholarship boy to Oxford or Cambridge in, let's say, 1800, you passed all the exams, you did all the right things, you would almost certainly be invited to take holy orders. Yet, and you wouldn't be trained. Mm. It was assumed that you would be of sufficient culture to get ordained, see the bishop, be hit on the head by the New Testament, and bingo, you were in.
Right.
But on the head, read what they write. Mm. But they're not cynics.
Right.
They're not skeptics.
It doesn't seem to be a simply a sort of cultural thing. It seems to be something they did.
I mean, one figure I'm fascinated by is William Dallinger, late 19th century Methodist minister working in the slums of Liverpool. FRS. Mm. William Dallinger, Methodist minister, FRS. He was a microscopist. He finally proved Darwin right.
Right.
Because he was studying fast-breeding bacteria.
Mm.
And he was studying their reactions to heat. And he was finding natural selection. So the man, you may say, gives experimental proof for Darwin was an FRS, a Methodist minister working in the slums of Liverpool.
FRS, for those uninitiated, standing for Fellow of the Royal Society.
In other words, you were in the top club.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Martin, I mean, obviously, this isn't your speciality exactly, but would you broadly agree with Alan's analysis there of the positive relationship between faith and science that has existed in the astronomical community over the last few hundred years?
I think I would, although, of course, it is fair to say, Alan, that if you were an academic, then you had a nice option in later life of becoming a nice country clergyman. And so lots of people did decide to take that route, especially at the time when fellows of colleges weren't allowed to marry.
Yes, so there was a fallback option, as it were.
But even when you look at people who were not clergy, medics, lawyers, people like that, you find a deeply, in their writings, a deeply Christian underpinning of their life.
Mm. Yes.
Yes, I'm not denying that.
Yeah. We're going to go to a quick break, and I want to come back talking about one of the first people you deal with, Edmund Halley, in the book. He's just a really interesting, colourful character, first of all. But but we'll start to pull out some of the discoveries that he was involved in and some of the other people as we go along. So we're talking today about Comets, Cosmology and the Big Bang. That's the name of Alan Chapman's new book, A History of Astronomy from 1700 to 2000. And drawing on the faith as well of those who were key figures in that. And we're also talking to Lord Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, and his recent book talks about the future, really, of where technology and science is taking us. That's On the Future, Prospects for Humanity. Join us again in a short moment's time.
Join me, Justin Brierley, as the big conversation continues with Daniel Dennett and Keith Ward.
Purposes emerge from the bottom up, from a purposeless process. That's the genius of Darwin's idea.
Well, I think that's a heroic project.
It is.
I don't think it's a possible one.
Michael Roos and John Lennox.
I think the physical resurrection is totally unimportant.
The problem of physical death has actually been solved historically. I want to know about it. To say it's irrelevant, I just don't understand, especially from a philosopher.
Join the conversation on life's biggest questions at thebigconversation.show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We're returning to our conversation now between Alan Chapman and Lord Martin Rees. Alan is the author of the book Comets, Cosmology and the Big Bang. Martin Rees, well known as the Astronomer Royal and a cosmologist and astrophysicist in the UK, former president of the Royal Society, and his latest book, On the Future, Prospects for Humanity, is how he believes we can prepare ourselves for the technological advances and challenges of the next few centuries. But Alan, your book is really looking back at the last few hundred years. And let's talk about Edmund Halley,
yes.
who is a fascinating
great
character.
Friend of mine.
I think even he may predate you a little bit. But let's one thing that emerges from reading the chapter on him is that he was obviously an ambitious person. In fact, he had his eyes set on this job of Astronomer Royal.
He fell on his feet at every stage in life.
Indeed. And sort of was not well liked by his predecessor, and who he took the job from after he passed away. That was something to do with the fact that he had published before it was corrected a manuscript.
Which was naughty on Halley's part, I fully admit. Because what we have to forget, you see, is the Astronomer Royal at that time, Flamsteed, the first one, we only received 100 a year. And he had to find all his own instruments, pay for his own staff, and he actually admitted to a visiting German scholar in 1710, had I not been the son of a rich merchant, I would have achieved nothing.
Right.
So in other words, being Astronomer Royal, he was paying for his own job. And he didn't like it when Halley got his nose poked in.
And I understand that the widow, once he passed away, sort of took away all of the astronomical instruments from
the
observatory.
Which is Flamsteed's own property.
So Halley had to sort of restock the observatory. But obviously, that aside, he obviously did make significant gains and insights into... What were some of the most significant things that Halley did?
I would say that Halley, in his wider career, was the founder of geophysics. Mm-hmm. He was the first great student of the internal structure of the Earth and magnetism. He was the first great student of auroral studies, aurora borealis studies. He was the first, what you would call, properly quantitative meteorologist. He was an immensely learned working astronomer. He discovered the proper motions of the stars, which indicate the Earth as moving in space. Many, many, many things. And he was a lifelong observer. He loved getting at the telescope. He was a Royal Navy captain. You know, how do you suddenly go from being a layman, a professor, to being Captain RN at one jump? Needless to say, he had a mutiny, but the mutiny was not the sailors, it was his first lieutenant. He'd been upstage. And Halley had this tremendous style.
He was fond of a drink as well, I understand.
He liked the drink. And his death was one of the most, I think, one of the most colourful in history. It was said he was 86, and he died on the 14th of January, 1742. He was talking with, I think it was his son-in-law, in the Royal Observatory, when he was still Astronomer Royal at that, still fit and perky. Mm. And he drank, it was said, quote, a bumper of brandy. Mm. Now, a bumper would be a bit like a beaker full of brandy. He was used to that. He sat down in his chair and...
And he was gone.
What a way to go.
I mean, one of the things that we do associate the Greenwich Observatory with is obviously Greenwich Mean Time and establishing, you know, that sort of the longitude is it
longitude,
that we
yeah,
can
yeah.
That passes through that place and so on. I understand at the time that he took on being Astronomer Royal, one of the key things they wanted to do was to be able to establish this longitude.
Yep.
And there was a great prize for the person who could, but he never quite managed it.
He never quite swung it. You see, he also found out too that he was actually eligible for it. Because the £20,000 prize was open to anybody, including an officer of state.
Right.
And so he was hoping to use the Greenwich Observatory to get this prize. He didn't quite manage it, but Halley was actually very well off in his own right. he was married. Well, he came from a wealthy city of London family, married a merchant's daughter in the city, all city connections, you see. Mm. And all throughout his life, he knew how to fall on his feet. And when he actually, when Queen Anne made a visit to the observatory, he reminded her he'd been formerly a Royal Navy captain for 4 years, and he got a pension as a captain thrown in as well.
Yes, very good, very good. Another person I'm rushing through here, there are many, many people detailed in the book, but Mary Somerville was an interesting chapter as well. Because you don't very often, let's face it, hear of women in astronomy. Yeah,
but one thing
and yet
I'm
she
very
was
much
a very significant one. Well,
and one thing I'm very much concerned with is trying to raise the profile of historical women, Caroline Herschel and people like that. She was a highly colourful lady.
Mary Somerville.
Mm. She was born the daughter of an admiral. Mary Fairfax was her maiden name. She fell in love with mathematics as a girl. Was not allowed to study it because it was thought by her father it will soften her brain and nobody will want to marry her. But she sneaked her brother's books, who was then a student at Edinburgh University. She taught herself higher mathematics, then married, and she was a very beautiful, very accomplished, highly, very, very likable lady.
Yeah.
Her first husband was a Russian diplomat, disapproved of thinking women, so she was kept quiet for 4 years. Then he died. Then, of course, she paid at Edinburgh. She paid the Regius Professor of Astronomy to give her private lessons in astronomy.
Wow.
And higher mathematics. And this is not just what's in the sky. This is Laplacian theory, Laplacian cosmology. She knew Newton like the back of his hand.
Right.
And after a few years, he had to tell her, I'm afraid I'll have to abandon you. You know more than I do. She then married a second time, Dr. Somerville, who was a cousin, and he was just the opposite, an eminent medic who was deeply proud of her.
Right.
And their careers didn't conflict. He was a doctor. She was a mathematician. He was an FRS. And their daughters later recorded that he would often spend days in the Royal Society Library copying out articles for her because she hadn't otherwise access to them.
Extraordinary. I mean, it makes you realise how times have changed.
Absolutely.
But in a sense, what a resourceful and obviously driven woman she was to want to express
Well, also, of course, she has a Trinity Cambridge connection too with Martin, you see, because in 1831 she was invited by Lord Brougham, who was a Lord Chancellor and various other things, to write up a modern digest of contemporary astronomy. She did this into a formidable work called The Mechanism of the Heavens. And in fact, a letter survives written by Dr. William Hewell, a friend of the family, to Dr. Somerville to say, and he was then Master of Trinity, to say that I am using your wife's book to teach the mathematical tripos in Cambridge. The first time a book by a woman was used to teach higher mathematics in a university.
And this was something of an astonishment to people at the time.
Well, in fact, at the time, there was one Devon MP brought up a question in Parliament apparently that it was unnatural and she shouldn't be allowed to do this. Women shouldn't be able to do that kind of thing. But Dr. Somerville was her full supporter.
Yes. And of course, her name, of course, now on the Oxford College that bears her name.
And of course, she didn't found it.
No.
She didn't have enough money for it. But when they founded Somerville College in Oxford in 1875, they were looking for an eminent thinking woman.
Because it was a female college.
Female college.
Yeah.
And at that time, of course, there was Girton in Cambridge. That was shortly after Newnham in Cambridge, Lady Margaret Hall in Oxford, and then, of course, several women's colleges in both universities.
Mm.
Very, very critical. Well, but she was actually, and all of her papers went to Somerville,
right.
And they're now in the Bodleian Library, where I've worked on them.
Well, I have a small connection there in as much as my mother went to Somerville College. Oh. So when it was still all female, I should say.
Yes.
But
my wife Rachel went across the road to St. Anne's.
There you go. And just before we come back to Martin and bring him into the conversation, at what level was faith an aspect of these people's lives, would you say?
Mary Somerville was not a, what you might call, a creedal church-going Christian. She was once condemned, she said, from the pulpit of York Minster by the dean, the Reverend Dr. William Coburn, for her advanced ideas. Mm. And she said in one amusing letter, I was condemned by name from the pulpit of York Minster. She was rather proud of that.
Right.
Yet she had a deep, deep faith in her salvation and in the love of God and of the complete Christian joy. Mm. She hated dogma. She hated catfighting. And bearing in mind, she's at the time of the Oxford movement, the evangelicals, the high church, are tearing skin off each other.
Mm.
And lots of people just couldn't stand that.
Mm.
Ditto in Scotland. We have the division of the Kirk in Scotland. There's a lot of ecclesiastical warfare. She was no part of it. She saw what was at the heart of it is the love of God, the beauty of nature, and the human intellect. And her passage when she was contemplating death at the age of 92, she just missed her 92nd birthday. She says, in very nautical terms, because clearly an admiral's daughter, she was waiting for her Blue Peter. And I once asked a naval friend what that was the flight they used to dip when HMS so-and-so was said, get ready for sea, in the days before radio. So you'd see your Blue Peter and he sat the voice. She said, I am waiting for my Blue Peter and I will leave port, friend, I will leave port easy and happy. I think the voyage will be a pleasant one. and I look forward to meeting many friends at the port of arrival.
There you go. What a lovely phrase. Martin, just to bring you back in here, I mean, that history that that Alan told there of the kind of things that Mary Somerville had to do in order to gain the education that she had and to be able to express her obviously naturally brilliant mathematical mind, it reminds us how much things have changed. I mean, but people still say that there are not enough women in science, not enough women in astronomy, astrophysics and so on. Do you think that's changing, Martin?
Oh, it changes hugely, of course. There are more in astronomy than other physical sciences, but not enough. But I think I so admire the way that Alan has highlighted the achievements of those women in the Victorian era and before, really against the odds. I think it's wonderful that they're now being more appreciated because they were not accepted in the institutions. The Royal Society wouldn't make women fellows until after World War II, which is quite astonishing.
Yes.
So there was this problem. But if I could go back to Halley, I would like to make a remark that, of course, he was an extraordinarily not only ambitious but adventurous person, because I think he was only 20 or 21 when he went out to make observations in St. Helena. I think that's right. And if you think of that, we thought of pretty adventurous now.
Yes.
But if you think of a young person of that age making what was obviously a dangerous voyage and being very isolated.
And St. Helena is a very remote island, isn't it?
Indeed it is. And even now we think that it was remote. But to go out there, you needed the courage and also the huge motivation.
Mm.
And I think what I admire most about all these early astronomers is how they were motivated, even though they didn't have all the sort of reinforcements we get now, because we're in a social community, and if we do some interesting work, people take an interest, etc. But Halley obviously went out in isolation and did this work because he thought it was important, and it was rather dangerous at the time.
I was just going to ask, a scientific perspective, what was the value of going to St. Helena Island, a very remote island in the, you know, the Atlantic?
Well, going further south, essentially.
Right.
To look more at the southern sky, and also to a good sight. But I just like to say that, of course, as you've said, Halley was a sort of privileged person. He had money and he had a good background and confidence. And I think, I don't know if Alan would agree, one has to admire even more people like Horrocks and Goodricker, people like who did important work in science, although they had no standing, no money, and were in isolation and didn't get much appreciation. And I think they needed far stronger motivation than anyone does now to get into science.
Absolutely. And of course, a classic case would be Sir William Herschel. Herschel is, after all, a German army bandsman who ends up FRS, friends of the President of the Royal Society, friend of the King, and of course, really the founder of modern deep space cosmology.
Mm.
I mean, and of course, he came to England originally as what they rather contemptuously called in those days a fiddle scraper. In other words, a performing musician.
Let's move to the early 20th century, because it's often not appreciated that one of the founders, really, of Big Bang cosmology was a Catholic priest, Father Georges Lemaître, a Belgian Catholic priest. Of course, this has been one of the most interesting fronts on the sort of boundary between science and theology, the whole question of cosmic beginnings and so on. Do you want to just tell us briefly a little bit about Georges Lemaître, Alan?
Georges Lemaître was a Belgian. He was, well, a Fleming, as would be called initially. He served in World War I as an officer, then had a deep religious calling and became a priest and a professor at the University of Leuven in Holland, Leuven. And he was a great, great mathematical cosmologist. He was not an observer. He was a great cosmologist. He knew Sir Arthur Eddington in England. Mm-hmm. He knew all everybody who was anybody.
He met with Einstein, I understand.
Knew Einstein, knew all of these people. And what really starts is in 1930, the January meeting of the Royal Astronomical Society, they were trying to have a meeting to get to the bottom of all these various theories, Einstein's theory, a curved universe, a theoretically expanding universe with no matter, and so on. And indeed, our Lemaitre was not present, but he'd heard of this because he was also an honorary fellow of the RAS in Belgium. And he writes to Eddington, sending him a paper he had published in a fairly obscure Belgian journal some years before, 1927, which basically drew all these bits together. And it was an expanding universe originating from what he called a cosmic egg or a primal atom. And Eddington read this and bang, it was... He did it. He had it translated into English, published by the RAS, and all of a sudden, Georges Lemaitre hit the big screen, as it were, in the astronomical world. And so many of the features could be of Einstein and Edouard de Sitter and so on, could be brought into this theory.
It was, nevertheless, still a controversial theory until it was, if you like, validated by the observation of cosmic microwave background radiation.
And that was quite late. That was in the 60s.
Yeah.
And so there's a highly controversial period in it. But nonetheless, it brought in more and more of the bits, as it were. And, of course, the steady-state theory by Sir Fred Hoyle was partly invented as a counter, largely because, of course, Hoyle did not like the idea of Roman Catholic priests.
I mean, I understand, I've heard that Fred Hoyle, you know, who actually coined, I think, the Big Bang terminology is a rather dismissive phrase for it, was dismissive of it partly, it could be argued, because he didn't like the implications of what a cosmic beginning might mean in terms of a creator and so on. Which is interesting, which suggests that it's not just scientific considerations that sometimes come into play when people are looking at different theories and which
people
they prefer.
People rarely ever are just scientific. We all have a load of baggage of beliefs, unbeliefs, likes and dislikes. And these, in many ways, guide our options. And I've always had a sense of wonder in science, back to childhood. And I have never found any fundamental conflict between that idea of wonder and the idea of a great creator. And I just can't see the blockage, but I fully accept other people do see the blockage.
It was your former tutor, Martin, who first, when I read his book, actually, a book of his, which explained, if you like, the fact that this universe was once, in the first, you know, milliseconds of the universe or smaller, the size of a house, and just a moment before that the size of a basketball, and a moment before that the size of a grape, until you get to this point which almost seems to be nothing. It almost blew my mind when I thought about the idea that all of physical reality came from this extraordinarily hot, dense, microscopic point in the past. And obviously it has led many, and perhaps we could talk about whether Lemaitre agreed with it or not, to you know, ask where did it come from? You know, why was there what appears to be a beginning? I mean, is that something you've spent much time thinking about yourself, Martin?
Yes, well, I think, if I can say a word about Lemaitre first, I think he was a great and underappreciated person, and you may know that the International Astronomical Union, just at its last meeting, decided that what is called the Hubble law for the expanding universe should be called the Hubble-Lemaitre law, because, as Alan has explained, it was in 1930 that he really himself realized this. But also on the issue between science and faith, I think, to be fair to Lemaitre, he did want to keep these separate. He believed in peaceful coexistence. And I think I'm right in saying that in the 1950s, the International Astronomical Union met in Rome, and the Pope made a speech. And the speech, I think, was written in consultation with Lemaitre, who is a member of the Papal Academy. And Lemaitre made a particular point that he didn't want to argue in favour of the Big Bang for any religious reasons.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
I think, Alan, is that
absolutely
your
correct
understanding?
He was, well, on one occasion, the Pope made a comment that this proves God, and Lemaitre, with the obvious caution you had to do when approaching the papacy, say, excuse me, Your Holiness, but don't push it too far.
And that's right, and this was the time when the steady-state theory was still in the running.
Right. That was a time when the steady-state theory was still in the running.
Still around, yes, in the early 50s. Yeah.
Yeah. In that sense, do you agree with Georges Lemaitre's caution about trying to extrapolate from scientific theories to, I suppose, transcendent realities such as God, Martin?
Well, I think if you look at what's happened in the science of cosmology, then until the 1960s, the very idea of a Big Bang was controversial. From the 1960s, it became pretty well accepted that everything started off hot and dense. Fred Hoyle never came round to that. He sort of compromised and believed in a sort of steady bang theory in his later years. Mm. Most people believed in the Big Bang. And I think it's fair to say that now we can describe the conditions of our expanding universe right back to about the first millisecond. That's because the physics of the material then was physics we understand, and we have actual fossils in the sense of the amount of helium and hydrogen and deuterium in the universe now, and those amounts were determined by what happened in the first minutes of the expanding universe. So we can extrapolate right back to the first millisecond, even perhaps a nanosecond, with as much confidence as anything a geologist can tell you about the history of the Earth.
Yes,
in my
which
opinion.
Is extraordinary. But I suppose the question is, can you go any further than that first?
Yes, well, of course you can't. And the reason is that if you extrapolate back to the first nanosecond, then the conditions which you infer are far more extreme than we can simulate on Earth, even in the biggest particle accelerators. And so the physics is then uncertain. So it's a challenge for the next 50 years to try and push things back further. And until we can do that, we can't answer basic questions like, why is the universe expanding the way it is? Why does it have the mix of atoms, radiation, and dark matter in it, etc.? So those are questions which for the next 50 years.
In your view, is it premature in that sense to leap to go from that to a evidence for a creator? In your view, Martin?
Well, I think it's never justified to make that leap. I think we just have to be modest and say there's mystery and wonder, and
it may be beyond
our understanding.
Right. How would you phrase that? Well, you have a lovely chapter, actually, at the end of your book, Alan, where...
May I just add comment about the Big Bang?
Yes, please do, yeah.
I do a lot of work with medical students in Oxford, in working in the history of science subject. And some years ago, I had a student who wanted to work with me on the early usage of lithium carbonate in psychiatric medicine. And I had a word of mine to a very good pal of mine who's a very eminent physician in Oxford. And I said, what do you know about the early history of lithium, Andrew? And he said, oh, yes, lithium, the oldest drug in the universe. It formed within 4 minutes of the Big Bang, you know. The element lithium.
There you go. Yes, absolutely. There you go. We'll go to another break now, and then we'll finish up by talking a little bit about the future as well. Perhaps Martin can give us his thoughts on what might be next, what's around the corner when it comes to astronomical research and discovery. And we'll conclude talking about the relationship between faith and science as well, as described in Alan Chapman's new book. This is a great edition, though, of the show. Very scientific but historical and fun conversation between my guests on Unbelievable today, Alan Chapman and Martin Rees. We'll be back in a moment's time.
Everything that God creates is for the purpose of redeeming human beings.
I'm telling you now, some of your prodigals, husbands, wives, children, brothers, sisters, are not so far from the kingdom as you think.
What has been done on the cross not only reaches into the human heart, but also into nature.
Everything within this world is screaming the name of Jesus, but he's also showing up in a face-to-face way.
Learn how to give reasons for the hope you have. Unbelievable, the Conference 2018, on DVD and digital download. Order now at premier.org.uk/shop.
Welcome back to the final part of today's edition of Unbelievable, the programme where we bring you conversations that matter every week. And don't forget that some exciting stuff in the pipeline for 2019. Our Unbelievable conference returns on Saturday, the 20th of July. We will be giving you more details on that as soon as we can. Can Science Explain Everything is our next event, being done in association with the Christian Union at Southampton University, who are hosting this particular event, and Christians in Science there as well. Can Science Explain Everything? I'll be moderating a discussion between Professor John Lennox, well known to this programme, And Peter Atkins, also well known to this show, as they debate that particular question. John has a new book out, Professor John Lennox, called Can Science Explain Everything? You can be there. You can be there in person if you're a student on the campus. You can attend the screening at Highfield Church that's going on live in Southampton on Thursday, the 31st of January at 7:30 p.m. Or you can watch it anywhere in the world via the Unbelievable YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/PremierUnbelievable. Other exciting things to let you know about just this very coming week. If you are a listener to Premier Christian Radio, you'll be able to hear my interview with Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, ranging over prayer, evangelism, speaking in tongues, politics, Brexit, the future of the Anglican Church, sexuality, LGBT issues. We covered a lot of ground, and you'll be able to hear that serialised on Inspirational Breakfast at about 10 to 8 each morning this coming week. So if you can tune in, do join me for that. And we'll be releasing the full audio and video of that as well on Unbelievable 2 in due course. And if you want to keep up with all of the good stuff that comes out from Unbelievable, then you should really be subscribed to our newsletter too. It's every other week that you get a roundup of some of the best stuff from the show, exclusive content, things that you didn't know you wanted to know but really should know. That's all available as well if you just subscribe at the website. PremierChristianRadio.com/Unbelievable. Hit the newsletter button and it'll tell you what to do. Still to come this afternoon, at the end of today's show, I'm going to be speaking to Frank Viola. He's the author of a number of books, but his latest is Insurgents, Reclaiming the Gospel of the Kingdom. Frank will join me after we finish today's discussion. And straight after Unbelievable on the profile, you can hear Sam Hale sitting down with Jackie Pullinger, who has a remarkable story. So many years of experience, pioneering work as an evangelist in China's Forbidden City. She's his guest on the profile, also available on its own profile podcast. Next week on Unbelievable, we're kind of going to be doing something that's sort of related to what we've been speaking about today. Raymond Tallis is an atheist philosopher with a really interesting new book out called Logos, in which he looks at that whole area of our sense-making abilities and why we have them. And you'll hear him in conversation with another really interesting mind, David Bentley Hart, who's an Orthodox theologian and philosopher. Look out for that in your podcast feed next week or here on Premier Christian Radio, Saturday at 2:30 p.m.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, it's been great fun tracing some of the interesting and colourful characters from the last 400 years of cosmology as related in your new book, Alan, Comets, Cosmology and the Big Bang, and hearing your own reflections as well on the way their faith informed what they did, and also, of course, hearing from Martin as well with his perspective as someone who isn't convinced, obviously, of God and that sort of thing.
I think also, to take on the point that Martin made, that I completely agree about not trying to use science to prove God.
Right.
Because even David Hume, the great 18th century philosopher who was not a believer, said you can neither finally prove the existence of God, neither can you prove the non-existence of God. And I see it's a faith issue, but I have no problem at all with my faith and my science. I mean, see the two as harmonious, but not provable.
Yes, in that sense, I was going to say, the way you put it across in the book, it strikes me that you talk about a remarkable consistency, let's say, between what you see in the universe,
congruence.
And your faith. So I'll just read a little bit from the very end of the final chapter, where you say, perhaps most wonderful of all, our eyes, brains and nervous systems can make sense of it all, of what looks like a stunning display of organized and connected coherence that embraces the micro and macro worlds, extending from the cells and synapses within our brains to the physics of black holes and the Big Bang. Even if some people, as far back as the Roman philosopher Lucretius in De Rerum Natura in 60 BC, have been trying to tell us what all this seeming coherence is an illusion, one is still left asking why. In purely Darwinian terms, it is hard to comprehend what kind of evolutionary survival advantage such a profoundly delusional understanding of the nature of reality could serve. So could it just be that we insignificant humans might possess something that is special after all, and that this specialness enables us to gain insight into the very nature of creation, and by extension that when we gaze into the starry sky, we might just be getting a glimpse into the mind of God. So it sounds like you're a little bit willing to sort of push things in the direction of God and ask, why is it that we have this extraordinary ability to comprehend our
universe? I don't know, but it is simply there. It is a thing which we don't share with butterflies, rabbits and monkeys. You can teach a monkey to do certain tricks and to do certain things, but you can't teach it to solve a quadratic equation, which is fairly low down on the mathematical scale. And I see, basically, humans as made in the image of God. I'm not a fundamentalist, but I certainly see that we are in God's image insofar that we share intellect, capacity, and moral realization. And so I believe that we have that, and that, I think, is unique.
And you find that a more satisfying explanation, that it coheres with your Christian faith, than it's sort of an accident of the cosmos?
Well, the thing is, I say, if it is an accident, well, it's a jolly wonderful one.
What's your view, Martin? Do you take a view on the fact that there is this remarkable coincidence of our reasoning and intellectual abilities and its ability to map out, you know, the universe in the way we do?
Yes. Well, I think that peroration in Alan's book is absolutely wonderful. Really, really eloquent.
Thank you, of course,
of the famous saying by Einstein, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible, that our minds are somehow attuned to making sense of it and understanding the laws. But one other point I'd make is that, again, Alan alluded to this, that the hardest things to understand may not be stars and galaxies and the Big Bang, but they may be living things.
Yes.
And even the brain. So it's complexity, which is the biggest challenge to our intellect, rather than perhaps stars and galaxies. So that may be where the deepest mysteries lie.
Go ahead, Alan, sorry.
I find it absolutely wonderful that what I refer to as 3 pounds of meat on the top of our spinal columns probably contains more wonder than the Andromeda Galaxy.
Even an insect,
It is remarkable, you know, from the very smallest things to the very largest things. We do live in a remarkable universe. And you describe yourself, don't you, Martin, as being someone who is full of awe and wonder in that sense. And I suppose awe and wonder sort of often does tip over into an almost religious sort of reverence for the extraordinary aspect of what we've been gifted. I mean, do you ever sort of... Does looking up into the stars, you know, as the psalmist puts it, and seeing things ever cause you to wonder, maybe there is a God beyond it all?
Well, it doesn't, because I wouldn't expect to maybe understand this. I mean, what I'd say is that most people find it hard to understand even a single atom. So I'm therefore skeptical of anyone who thinks they've got any genuine understanding of anything deep. So I share Darwin's view that these are beyond what the human mind can expect to understand, and that's why I'm allergic to dogma. But could I just say one thing,
which is
a special perspective which I think astronomers offer, and that is an awareness of the far future as well as the past.
Yes.
I mean, we know that the Earth's been around for 4.5 billion years and the Big Bang happened 13.8 billion years ago, even those people who are happy with this evolutionary path, which has led to the wonders Alan's described, many of them tend to think that we humans are the sort of culmination of it all. I find it hard to believe that, because the sun is less than halfway through its life, and the universe may have a far longer future ahead of it. So it seems to me that we are a particularly crucial stage in the emergence of complexity in the universe. We are a special species. We're the first species which can wonder about our place in nature. But I don't think we should consider ourselves a culmination. I think we can conceive that there may be intelligences far beyond our own, which could develop from humans, or indeed may be out there already, because another fascinating question is there life elsewhere in this enormous cosmos? So I think we should realize that there may be mysteries and wonders that we're not aware of and could never even understand with our brains. So I think that makes me adopt a sort of cosmic modesty.
I fully accept that. I fully accept that, because I think we construe wonder in different ways, depending on, like I say, belief systems and so on. To me, it entitles me to a sense of Christian wonder, but I can fully understand another person who doesn't share that. But the key thing is the wonder and the realization that the science can never, or at least so far, make the jump to explain the absolute truth. The science is a wonderful indicator, but there's something you call it wonder, God, whatever, something bigger beyond.
It's just been a lovely conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you ever so much, Martin, and thank you very, very much for coming to talk on.
Yeah, absolutely. Martin, thank you for being the interlocutor with Alan today on the programme. And if people want to find out more about your book, it's available, of course, at, in all good places where you find books. I'll make sure there's a link from today's show. And it is called On the Future, Prospects for Humanity.
Very good to be speaking to you and Alan.
And thank you very much, Alan, for being
it's
with us.
It's a great, great pleasure to talk with Martin.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hope you enjoyed today's show. Do get in touch if you want to send me an email. It's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you'd like to get in touch via social media, our Twitter account is @unbelievablejb. Follow me there, send me a message, I'm sure I'll respond to you. Facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow the show via Facebook. And there are other ways of getting in touch too. You can leave a comment underneath the latest edition of the show at the website too, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Going to be looking at a little bit of your feedback in a moment's time. Just wanted to mention, though, last week's show, which has had a really interesting response, Jonathan Haidt and Andrew Wilson asking, are we raising a snowflake generation? I told you about Jonathan Haidt's book, The Coddling of the American Mind. Failed to mention, Andrew Wilson actually has a new book out. It's called Spirit and Sacrament, An Invitation to Eucharismatic Worship. Now, that sounds interesting, doesn't it? And the good news is Andrew's going to be coming back on Unbelievable to talk about that and to have a dialogue on the gifts of the Spirit with another Christian who perhaps doesn't take the same view as him on whether they are in operation in the same way today as Andrew believes they are. So look out for that. Well, I'm really pleased to be joined on the show now by Frank Viola, who is the author of a number of books. His latest is called Insurgents, Reclaiming the Gospel of the Kingdom. Frank, welcome along to the programme.
I am honoured to be on, Justin.
It's great to have you on. I've come across your work before, Frank. I think the book that really introduced me to you was Pagan Christianity, though I know you've been authoring books for a long time now. Do you want to just sort of give us an idea of where your interests have been over the years and where you find yourself now on the journey you've gone on spiritually over those years?
Yes, sir. Well, I am a bit of an iconoclast and a provocateur, I guess. I'm someone who became a Christian when I was 16 years old, started following Jesus Christ then, and I have just really been turned off by most of what I see in modern day Christianity. And I can understand why skeptical people, people who are not Christians, have rejected the faith. And so I was looking for a lifeline to find the reality of Jesus Christ and the scripture. And so that's been my journey, discovering things that have been overlooked. Pagan Christianity came out 10 years ago. George Barna and I wrote that, and that took it took dead aim at all of the traditions that men have created to replace what the vibrant, exciting, magnetic ecclesia of God, body of Christ, church, quote unquote, was in the first century and how that can be recovered today. And yeah, that definitely created a lot of a stir in Christian circles, but it set a lot of people free because many people have in their heart this question. There's got to be something more than this when it comes to modern day church. And that book still does very well, Pagan Christianity. The recent journey has led me on to write another book 10 years later called Insurgents, Reclaiming the Gospel of the Kingdom. And what that book does, Justin, is it does what pagan Christianity did for church by kind of deconstructing and reconstructing it. This book does with the kingdom of God and the whole issue of the gospel. What is the gospel exactly? And how come it's so anemic and diluted and essentially the power that was retained in the first century, why has it been lost to us today?
I often see in the skeptical world, where we often are doing these kind of engagements here on Unbelievable, a sense that often skeptics are the ones to say, well, you know, the message is great, as far as I can see from the Gospels, but its expression in the church seems so unlike the Christ that you claim to represent. And I think they look at the culture wars in the USA, particularly perhaps, they look at some of the scandals. They look at, you know, the way the church often gets it wrong in that sense. I mean, do you think this kind of a book will help that kind of a person who says, I don't think the church is what it's supposed to be right now?
Absolutely. But more than that, it will actually give them a brand new look at the gospel that Jesus preached, that Paul preached, in comparison to what most Christians and most non-believers think the gospel is today. And in my personal judgment, the gospel that was preached in the first century, that Jesus Christ, Paul Tarsus, Peter, etc., the rest of the apostles preached, was so dynamic and so explosive that it made people quake. It turned over governments. It caused riots. It was something that was so incredible that we have lost that cutting edge. We've lost the power, the ignition of that gospel today. And that's why I wrote Insurgents. When I came to realize that myself, it absolutely radicalized my Christian life. And so I wanted to share those discoveries with others. And I titled it Insurgents because that's exactly what this gospel, the gospel of the kingdom, as Jesus called it, produces. It produces an insurgence. And we're starting to see, it's really the size of a man's hand right now, but we're seeing an insurgence begin to sweep the United States and spreading abroad to other countries. And it's a very powerful thing. And people who are not Christians are now relooking at the Christian faith with brand new spectacles, saying, you know what? I never heard it like this. Yeah. And this really is attractive.
you begin the book by defining the term insurgents. You give a dictionary definition here: a noun, an organized opposition intended to change or overthrow existing authority. And synonyms would be insurgency, insurrection, revolt, revolution, sedition, uprising. You say that there is an insurgence going on across the USA. I guess, yeah. Responding to what you see as this insipid, anemic, kind of culturally manifested form of Christianity, which for you is simply not the gospel as it was given to us in the New Testament. What is the new, if you like, the recovered gospel you see others who actually propounding? And it'd be interesting to hear what other people you see doing that alongside you, Frank.
Yeah, well, you know, it's hard to put that in a soundbite, but what I can tell you is what it's not. Mm. Right now in the United States, most people equate Christianity with the conservative right politically, okay? And so evangelicals, quote unquote, are the equivalent of people who are part of the political conservative right. Well, the gospel of the kingdom has nothing to do with that. In fact, it takes dead aim at that. On the other hand, many Christians, when in realizing the hypocrisy and some of the callousness that's on the conservative right politically, they've swept over to the progressive left, okay? And they have equated the gospel with the agenda of the progressive left. And yet the gospel of the kingdom takes dead aim at the progressive left also. In fact, one of your guests in the past, Greg Boyd, who wrote The Myth of a Christian Nation, he and I had a dialogue, one-hour dialogue. People can find it on YouTube. Just type in Frank Viola and Greg Boyd. They'll see it at the top. We had a conversation about the gospel of the kingdom, and we explore this whole issue of how the gospel has turned political, and that's why it has been drained of its power to change lives and to radically change society even. And so people can look at that to get into it. But what I'm suggesting is that the gospel of the kingdom is something more powerful, more titanic, more explosive than all these other things. Yes.
Yeah. And indeed, that's what you spend, you know, what is a very hefty book unpacking. In fact, I'd say that, you know, now each chapter, and I use that word advisedly because really each segment, if you like, is only a page or so long.
Yes,
so it's concise in that way, but there are so many of them. There's probably enough for one for every day of the year or something like that, if you were just to go through it. But what's your aim then? Is it just to teach a number of lessons about what this kingdom, what this gospel should look like compared to what it often is expressed like in the contemporary church?
Yeah, that's part of it, to give the vision of what it is, which really in itself is a game changer, but also, Justin, to make it a practical living reality in the lives of everyone who reads the book. And that's why after each section of the book, there is a taking action section, and it leads and navigates the reader to go through very practical exercises of how they can basically be changed by the gospel of the kingdom and respond to it individually and also corporately. And what's happening now is that those who have read the book, many of those who have read the book, are now forming what we call kingdom cells, C-E-L-L-S. This is not a new nifty word for a church. This is the analog to what radical terrorists have, sleeper cells, okay? We call the gospel, the kingdom, the true radicalization. And that's exactly what it was in the first century. And that's why the Roman Empire was turned on its ear by the message and the life of these people who were followers of Jesus Christ, who was the new king in their eyes and in their hearts. And so kingdom cells are now forming, and we talk about how to form a kingdom cell in the book as people navigate and are gripped by the message and are changed by the message and want to connect with other people to begin to join this insurgence that's happening right now.
Yeah, I could tell from reading that people like Greg Boyd would have been, you know, significant partners and influencers in this kind of a way of looking at things. I also got a sense of maybe the theology of N.T. Wright has also been influential upon you, Frank.
A little bit. Although I think, you know, in my judgment, N.T. Wright stops short on some of this and kind of tilts a little bit more to the progressive left, where the gospel of the kingdom kind of breaks through both the left and the right and transcends it by giving a completely different vision and version. Jesus Christ was opposed to both the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and the Pharisees were the first century equivalent to the conservative right of his day. And he gave them fits, running fits constantly. And Jesus Christ was also an opponent to the Sadducees, who were the equivalent of the progressive left of our day, and he gave them apoplexy. So his message is so different from either the left or the right. But certainly, I do cite various authors who have put some of the kingdom pieces of the puzzle together and have presented a kind of a fresh look at the whole thing. And yeah, Greg Boyd and I had a great conversation, and people can find it on YouTube if they want to check that out, where we go into it. It's a lot of humor too, so you got to have a sense of humor to to stay with us. But yeah, definitely we're tracking on a lot of this as well.
Right. Well, look, it's a fascinating book. Insurgents.org, I believe, is that where you can find out more about the book and even get some free sample chapters of it?
Absolutely. Yeah, people can watch interviews, listen to interviews, listen to spoken talks, and even samples of the book, both print and audio. Insurgents.org, and their different retailers where they can pick the book up. But yeah, it really is causing quite a stir. I'm very happy with it. It reminds me of what pagan Christianity did 10 years ago, and that is it really caused an eruption. Somebody described it as a bomb dropped on the playground of the Christian playground. And I think this book is doing the same thing with respect to the gospel of the kingdom.
Well, all the very best for it, and thank you very much for coming on the show to talk to me. Thanks, Frank.
My privilege. Thank you.
Well, before we have to wrap up, I've time for a couple of emails that have come in relation to recent additions to the show. This one, though, was just a general note of appreciation and some questions on the back of Unbelievable, the book. It's available now. It's the story of the show and why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. You can get a signed copy from our website. That's unbelievablebook.co.uk. Preston got in touch via Facebook to say, I recently read your book, Justin, really liked it. Very well written, and think you have persuaded me in a way no other book has, that Christianity really has. Compelling arguments backing it and a lot of objective evidence to support it. I think I'm close to laying my doubts aside. However, I have a couple of quick questions. Well, you call them quick. They're quite big ones here, Preston. One thing you briefly touch on the book is the rapid rise of Christianity and how it's one of the minimal facts that help to show that the resurrection really occurred. And I remember on one of the shows, John Loftus, I think, said that hardly anybody in Jerusalem believed that Jesus rose from the dead, so why should he? And I've seen similar arguments from Bart Ehrman in his book saying that almost all the early converts were outside of Jerusalem, though I can't recall either of them providing any evidence for that view either way. Wondered if you knew of anything I could read or listen to that deals with the question. question, as I think it's a pretty compelling component of the resurrection discovery, in whichever way the evidence points, if there is any. And secondly, you say, the worldview I often find myself being drawn to as an alternative to Christianity is deism. Do you know of any resources that specifically deal with that worldview and why it may be lacking in comparison with Christianity? Though I guess the resurrection is probably a big point in that discussion. Thanks for all your work. I think you're a really great host and author. Always grateful for your honesty and sincerity. Very, very kind words. Thank you, Preston. I'm obviously absolutely humbled and honoured that you've read the book and find that it does provide some compelling evidence for Christianity. As to your questions, probably best one of the people best placed to two of the people, I suppose, best placed to answer that question on that minimal fact about the growth of the early church and why it gives evidence for the explanation that the first apostles gave of the resurrection of Christ would be the people who really developed that minimal facts argument. Mike Licona and Gary Habermas, they wrote a book on the resurrection of Jesus together, which really set the trend for that particular way of arguing for the resurrection. I'm sure you'll find something there that helps to spell out their particular reasons for why they think that particular piece of evidence is a compelling one. As to deism, I don't know much, actually, that specifically engages with deism. I always think of deism as almost a 19th century sort of fad and isn't much in fashion any longer. A god who began the universe but then steps back and doesn't have any further involvement in it. I suppose, yes, it is the claims of Christianity, the personal aspect of God, the resurrection, that are directly, obviously, speak to that. All the very best with your journey, Preston. Very encouraged to hear that the book's been helpful for you on that journey. Let's go for one more email. This is someone who wants to get in touch about the Peter Singer and Andy Bannister debate that took place as the final conversation in our big conversation series last year. They were debating, can we be good without God? It ranged on to all kinds of issues around ethics and utilitarianism and where how we ultimately decide what is the best life, how we measure that. Now, this is an email that came in from Kerry. I'm going to read it in its entirety. Kerry lives in Australia and says, "G'day from Brisbane." I won't do an Australian accent for the rest of this email. "I've been listening to Unbelievable for 4 years now and find it refreshingly genuine as a programme that attempts to offer a fair hearing to advocates on both sides of an issue. It was with interest I listened to the programme with Professor Peter Singer. Although there have been many times I've considered writing in to Unbelievable about an episode, this is the first time a broadcast has troubled me so much since it aired that, after relentless prompting, I felt morally compelled to put pen to paper. I find it ironic that Professor Peter Singer focuses so much on the alleviation of suffering as a rationale for his views. He obviously fails to recognise the profound emotional suffering he continually inflicts on others by the dissemination of his outdated historical assumptions, ill-informed prejudices, and glaring ignorance with respect to the lives of individuals with trisomy 21, also known as Down syndrome, and their families. Ultimately, if, in his utilitarian view, he has no qualms about eliminating newborns, it would appear rather fruitless to try and persuade him of the humanity of embryos with extra chromosomes. My son has Down syndrome. As I write this, he's just entered the room, to the palpable delight of his younger siblings. If the elimination of suffering factors so much in Dr. Singer's moral decisions, it would make sense to look at the data. I've struggled to find a single individual in history with Down syndrome who's ever been guilty of serial killing, homicide, rape, terrorism, tax evasion, drink driving, massacre, or crimes against humanity. I can't find any newborns similarly indicted. Professor Singer's nebulous criteria for personhood results in the goalpost being constantly moved to determine who is morally relevant. It's not unlike the former apartheid regime in South Africa and their mercurial method of racial profiling. As the parent of non-identical 8-month-old twins who are so clearly individual in their personalities and preferences, I fail to see where they fall short as persons and can be so easily eliminated under Professor Singer's contorted logic. To measure the lives of 200 pigs against that of a newborn makes no sense when applied to Professor Singer's own utilitarian scale. Even at maturity, 200 pigs in a barn won't produce one that can drive a car, read a book, or utter a single sentence. The newborn's brain is already far superior in its wiring than any mature animal known. Professor Singer's humble brag about giving to the poor indicates that there are some classes of humans who qualify for his consideration simply based on a single criteria, their bank account. Or to be consistent, is he careful to stipulate his funds only be given to impoverished individuals who also meet his exacting rules for personhood? It is offensive in the extreme that he's allowed to espouse such abhorrent and devaluing views about individuals with disability. Yet, were he to have similar views about prenatal testing for gender or sexual orientation, this would be considered hate speech in the current climate. To paraphrase Martin Luther King, I have a dream that my 5 children will one day live in a nation where they will be judged by the content of their character and not by the number of chromosomes they have. The risk of causing reciprocal offence, from my point of view, Peter Singer, with his eugenic rhetoric, seems to have a rather significant ethical and moral disability himself. By his own criteria, such a moral failing should be considered equally burdensome and disqualify him from full personhood. The life and legacy of Stephen Hawking alone should give him pause, or is he completely ignorant of current research and the importance of the least dangerous assumption? Part of me recognising that Professor Singer's ideas are absurd and illogical, and that they're not worthy of refutation. Unfortunately, his views are bizarrely given a prominent platform and robust following that means it's dangerous to not refute them. As Voltaire insightfully observed, those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. There are many kinds of suffering. In my experience, emotional suffering outstrips physical suffering by a mile. Professor Singer falsely assumes that most parents of a child with a disability see their son or daughter as a burden. That is clearly not so, and research has proven it time and again. Unless he's being deliberately obtuse, Professor Singer is a glaring example of those in society who continue to cause undue suffering to individuals with disability through ignorance and intractable prejudice. Professor Singer is certainly entitled to his own opinion, but he is not entitled to his own facts. That was Kerry in Australia. Well, leaves you in no doubt where you stood on that issue. Thank you very much. Anyone is welcome, of course, to send in emails for or against any of the shows that we broadcast here on Premier, including all of those big conversations that have been so popular. Don't forget, you can watch those as well on video at our Big Conversation website, thebigconversation.show. Planning to bring you another season of that later on this year. Another exciting thing to come from the Unbelievable Stable. Thanks to everyone who's been in touch, for all my guests on the show today, and for you for listening. And I hope you can join me again at the same time next week. You're unbelievable. We'll be looking at the Logos. Is there a sort of logic, a creative principle at work behind ourselves and the universe? How do we make sense of our place within this cosmos? Two brilliant thinkers join me, Raymond Tallis and David Bentley Hart. Don't miss it. This time next week, here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Unbelievable. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.